Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the Court is now sitting. God save the State of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the Court has three matters on its oral submission docket. This afternoon, the Court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of the presentation, they are as follows. Harris County versus Lynn Smith and others from Harris County and the First District Court of Appeals. The second argument is State of Texas versus One Super Cherry Master Video 8-Liner Machine and others from Burnett County and the Third District Court of Appeals. Consolidated for oral argument with Milton Wayne Hardy and Lovell Green Hardy versus the State of Texas from Johnson County and the 10th Court of Appeals District. And the final argument is City of Dallas versus James and Charlotte Jennings from Dallas County and the 5th Court of Appeals District. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and complete these arguments by the end of the day. Justice Snyder is not sitting in the first case. We are recording these arguments, and you may purchase a tape of any argument by the payment of a nominal fee with our clerk. We are ready to hear argument from petitioner in Harris County versus Smith.
May it please the court, Ms. Sandra Haslam will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Sandra Haslam. I represent Harris County. The focus of this case is the reversible error standard that's been applied in the state, and the issue before this court is whether that reversible error standard in this case involving an improperly submitted element of damages unsupported by evidence over objection and a brought from question constitutes reversible error. I believe the answer to that question is yes for three reasons. First, precedent of this court, including Bonney versus San Antonio, which was decided in 1959. Second, principles articulated by this court, including the principle that all parties have the right to a jury correctly instructing the law, as well as the open courts provision, which gives people the right to have their grievances addressed. Thirdly, because of the prospect of what could happen if this court decided to retract from its principles on this type of error.
Now, if we agreed with your argument, wouldn't the logical conclusion be that we would end up with a series of blanks in a jury form as opposed to broad form submission?
You know, the law has been this way for many years. 1959, when the Bonney decision was decided.
Which was before our broad form submission rule that mandates.
Correct. That's correct. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well, isn't that a significant difference?
The reversible error rule is the focus here. Not the whether we came into, just had a new rule about whether you do broad form submission. Because that reversible error standard has been the same past the time that we had broad form submission. It's been the law all along. We haven't had a problem. And yet now it's being urged, at least it has since 92 in an article by Dorsenio, that maybe this is going to have some effect. Now, Dorsenio did not really do a very thorough, at least, well, I shouldn't say that because I don't want to criticize him because I think he's a great author, but I think he didn't really do the more stringent review that the Baylor Law Review did in deciding what was a reversible error standard in Texas with respect to this type of error.
Well, but Dorsenio took the same position as the United States Supreme Court has taken, didn't it?
The United States Supreme Court took that position in a criminal case applying federal common law, and in our state, we have a rule, 44.1. That rule has been the same since 1941, essentially. It has two components. One of those components is that you find that there was error, where it probably causing rendition of an improper judgment, and a second component, which was cited by this court in the Castile opinion, is the component that it probably prevented the appellant from properly presenting their case to the Court of Appeals.
Well, we can say that on legal theories, I think, but on this charge, we have the jury instructed to consider each element of damages individually, if any, and not to blend the elements. So isn't that a distinction that what you're really arguing is possibly harmed rather than probable. You're presuming the jury did not follow those instructions.
The jury was told to consider each of the elements, including one which should not have been submitted. There's no question it should not have been submitted.
There but if, no, doesn't if any take care of that?
Well, you know what the court in Bonnie said, what this court said in 1959? This is what it said happens when you have a jury instructed to consider that. It says the jury speculates. Now, that is something that this court can allow. And then these are the problems that will occur as a result of that.
Okay, now, you've given us the list of principles in this, but you haven't told, and it may be error, but I don't understand how all of this ties to a reversible error analysis. How does it tie into harmful error? It's one thing for it to be error. It's another thing to show that it's harmful error. And I don't understand how the various things that you're talking about lead to the conclusion that this is harmful error.
Well, this court has long recognized that it's harmful when a party tries to get an instruction where it's properly instructing them on something they can do in the case, in this case, awarding damages. And they're being told to consider something that they legally should not be told that they can consider. We don't know if the jury considered it or
that's
not.
That's error. That's not the harmful error standard. And what my question to you is, which I think is a follow-up to what Justice O'Neill was asking, was how do you get over the hurdle in terms of the probably caused harm that's required under the reversible error standard?
Right. Well, the standard that this court cited in Castile was subpart 2, which whereas it probably prevents the appellant from properly presenting their case.
Is it?
And that's harm. That's harmful. Because in our state, and the reason that...
What is wrong with the Court of Appeals analysis? The Court of Appeals in this case agreed with you as to your argument on two of the three no evidence points that you raised. But then it proceeded, and so it was error to submit those, but then it proceeded to perform a traditional harmful error analysis. What is wrong with the analysis that the Court of Appeals applied?
Well, I would disagree that it's traditional for this court, because this court in the Bonney case decided it in 1959, which is 20 years after this court adopted
this
standard.
I know, but tell me what's wrong with the looking at the analysis that they performed. They reviewed they reviewed the charge in its totality. They reviewed the evidence in the totality. They went through everything under the approach to looking at harmful error in a jury charge that this court has said needs to be followed. What was wrong with that analysis?
What's wrong with that analysis is that it does not take into account the fact that the jury was not, we don't know that the jury didn't consider it. It does not take that into account.
That's a possibility. That's not probability.
Okay. Well, that was just the same possibility that was in Castile. That was the same possibility in Bonney. And in those cases, the court found it was reversible error. This court found harm.
And Castile has been subject to comment that we, in fact, changed the law with respect to that type of a charge, that, in fact, that was a change.
I just disagree with that,
right?
Because subpart 2 clearly envisions a 44.1A. Clearly envisions this court looking at the fact that this is a type of error where the appellant probably was prevented from being able to show just how much harm was involved. And, you know, our open court provision
I don't see in the analysis applied by the Court of Appeals here that you can show that there was probably harm.
When a jury is being told that they can consider something, and you don't know if they did consider it, the fact that they may have considered other elements of damages does not give us comfort that they were able to find it on the proper basis.
So you're asking us to say that under these circumstances it's per se harm. That if in fact the charge is submitted in the jury and contains an element of damage for which there's no evidence, even with the appropriate conditioning instruction, the if any language, that it is always harm and therefore must always be reversed.
There may be situations like in the Boatland case or some other case where you have a situation where you can show in the charge itself that it wasn't harmful.
Give me one of those.
Well, in the Boatland case, you had several questions, and the question that was given that was harmful was basically nullified by the jury's answer to another question. that was in the same
charge.
But in
a broad form submission, a broad form damage submission, as was submitted in this case, mm-hmm. when would you ever have a case where it would not be harmful error?
I guess the only case would be where the damages were proven conclusively as to certain damage elements.
No, as to if we had one element included for which there was not any evidence.
Right, but what I'm saying is if the other elements were proved conclusively as a matter of law, that would be a circumstance where it's not, you couldn't prove.
I don't understand that.
Well, if, for example, you had a situation where you found liability and the question asked for, say, medical expenses only, the jury came out with an amount that was exactly the amount of the medical expenses and they were entitled to it as a matter of law, then...
Now, I'm talking about a multiple
yeah, I'm saying
element.
That if that was with, and the wrong submission was with it, I'm sorry.
In this case, if the jury had filled in the blank $67,000, would you be arguing for reversal? In this case, if the jury had filled in $67,000 as opposed to $90,000, would you be arguing for reversal?
Probably not. Probably it wouldn't be as persuasive as this case. Actually, I probably still would, because in this particular case, we also had a problem, because there was evidence of prior back injuries, so the jury wasn't getting the full amount.
But you don't have that issue in front of us, in front of this court.
Well, I'm just saying that that's one of the reasons the amount was less than the medical that they probably were awarded.
Well, let me ask you a question. If we follow your line of reasoning, doesn't that effectively do away with broad form submission?
No, it doesn't, because it's been the law in this state
for over 43 years. You would never know, because you could come forward and say, I object, you're submitting request for damages elements for which there's no evidence. The trial judge says, I disagree, and submits it. The moment you make that objection, would not the judge be obligated to then submit special issues to avoid the problem that if he's wrong or she's wrong and it goes up on appeal, the whole case comes back? Whereas a simple solution is just don't submit broad form,
well,
put them all out separately, and then we go back to special issues.
Certainly a judge could do that. What happens if they don't have review by this court to let them know there's an incentive to do that? There's no disincentive to a party offering proper instructions on damages. You can get a list of different factors where there's no evidence to support it.
Well,
how is that fair?
Could the judge submit that issue separately and have the rest of them submitted broad form? In other words,
correct.
Submit the issue about which there's
a question
about
and
whether there's
evidence. And
that would
be a solution, obviously. And then it would continue to have the fair process
there.
Well,
but except... unless the advocate wants to preserve a factual sufficiency challenge, and then it's going to be incumbent upon them, if they want to raise factual sufficiency in the Court of Appeals, to separate those elements out as well.
Correct.
So then...
unless they want to do this to that particular point.
Well, so the careful advocate is going to object to each individual element to preserve a factual sufficiency argument on appeal.
Counsel, yes. You said in... I'm sorry, go ahead and answer.
Sorry. I didn't think that was... Was that a question? I'm sorry.
I think you said yes, that they are going to have to separate out to preserve factual sufficiency.
If you're an appellant, you probably would ask for that, but then of course I don't think it would be a reversible error, probably not separating it out.
Why not?
But you couldn't review it for factual sufficiency. You'd be prevented from reviewing an individual element for factual sufficiency unless you pulled it out. So your argument would lead to that result.
Well, possibly.
Counsel, in your opening statement, you pointed out that this charge was properly objected to.
Correct.
Would your argument be different if there had been no evidence objection at the trial court?
If there had not been an objection?
Yes.
If there had not been an objection, I'd have nothing to argue.
Evidence doesn't have to be.
Well, no evidence point can be brought up after the case, obviously, but that's a different error. This case is not about presuming error.
It's about presuming harm.
It's a totally different issue. Equal justice under the law will not be furthered in this case if this court changes its traditional analysis in this context.
If we adopt your approach to this, what would we do with Thomas versus Older that talks about, which seems to me to be on point in this case and requires us to look at the damage evidence as a whole? Do we have to overrule it?
No. Thomas versus Older was a case where we're looking at error. I have error in this case. The court erred in giving an instruction that gave the plaintiff more than they should have had. In the Thomas v. Oldham case, the error was factual insufficiency, legal insufficiency. That's different than my case. you had to decide whether there was insufficient evidence to support an element, and the court said you could only consider it as a whole because the charge was given to them that way, even though the juries made little notations by each. So that's the way the court reviewed it.
Maybe I misunderstood. I thought in this case the reason it was error to submit damages instruction was because there's no evidence of those damages.
There's no evidence, correct.
So this is a sufficiency question.
No, the question is the improperness of submitting this charge with an element that has no evidence. The focus is the error in the court not doing what we asked the court to do with respect to that.
I thought you said that the distinction between this and Oldham was that in Oldham that was a factual, that was a sufficiency question,
and this is
a legal question.
This is a question with respect to the charge. This is a charge error problem.
But don't you have to fall over and do a sufficiency analysis in order to do the harmful error analysis?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
You have to fall over into doing a sufficiency analysis if you're going to make a decision, first of all, whether or not there was error, and second of all, whether or not there was harmful error. I don't see how you can separate the two.
I have to first prove that it was error for the court not to do what I requested, true, but the harmful error analysis then goes to whether it was improper for the court to submit it in that manner.
That's the error analysis, not the harmful error analysis. The harmful error analysis is going to still require you to look, as the Court of Appeals did here, in terms of the totality of the evidence to determine whether or not it caused harmful error.
Well, I disagree with that because that's not what this court did in Bonnie.
We ask the court to reverse. Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Willie Coleman will present an argument for the respondents.
Counsel, when I was trying these cases, which was a long time ago, generally the person bringing the suit wanted as many different lines as possible of damages, hoping the jury might get on a roll and money might add up. Why did you want it all in one claim?
Judge, simply following the broad form rule that in most instances is appropriate to have the broad form unless there is a special circumstance when you should not do that. It was my attempt to follow that rule in having the broad form submission.
So you weren't worried about there no evidence? If you had thought there no evidence objection had merit, you would have consented.
If I had thought that there was a problem with the evidence, I would have. I thought that there was sufficient evidence to support that issue going before the jury, and the Court of Appeals disagreed with me.
Well, but you don't think so now.
Yeah, that's what...
You don't think so now.
I yield to the will of the First Court.
Well, I thought you told them that you didn't disagree with that. Is that not right? Did you concede that in the Court of Appeals, or you just...
I did.
Yeah.
And I do. Today.
But let me ask you this about the record. It seems to me that there was some evidence from which the jury could have concluded that Lynn Smith's ability to work was impaired. The only problem was there was no dollar evidence put on. There was no dollar amount put on that evidence. So couldn't the jury have speculated, saying, you know, even when he played with his kids, he had to go to bed for 2 days, and this did impair his earning capacity, and then on their own come up with some number like they would for mental anguish, put some dollar amount on all of that evidence that clearly showed he was impaired.
When you couch it in those terms, I think that was part of my thinking at the time that the charge session was going on in this case, and I believe that the evidence at that point in time supported those issues being submitted to the jury.
Counsel, if we were to agree with you in this case, why wouldn't we have a very large problem in Texas with lawyers deliberately submitting elements that there wasn't evidentiary support on or they weren't sure about, not proving their case, and then being thoroughly protected on appeal and there being no basis for anyone to ever complain?
Well, for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think we have to trust lawyers to appropriately present their cases before juries. Secondly...
So you're going to hang your argument on that? You win or lose on that?
Secondly, I think that what prevents that is that there still has to be review about whether or not there was sufficient evidence to support, and it still has to stand up, the case still has to stand up on appeal.
But practically there is no review in the end. I mean, if we adopt your reasoning, then there is no consequence to lawyers submitting in trial courts, charging the jury with elements on which there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever. So the jury's instructed on that, and the jury may possibly award damages based on that element, and yet what the Court of Appeals and you are saying is there's no review whatsoever.
I think also what some of the cases indicate is that we are counting on trial judges to make sure that based upon the evidence that issues that should not make it in front of the jury will not make it in front of the jury.
But we have seen case after case, appellate cases, in which the Court of Appeals say, just like they did here, yes, there was error in submitting that, but we can't touch it, either because broad form submission is the rule or because there are other elements in there, mental anguish and others that have no mathematical certainty to them, so we can't tell whether the jury gave money for an element of damage that wasn't presented in the evidence.
There are occasions in the law where simply you approach an issue in the most efficient manner that you can, and I think that the approach that exists now with the broad form submission and with the harmful error review is the best that our system can provide at this time.
If there hadn't been any evidence of impairment at all, it might be one thing, but I'm struggling with that. Can you help me? Because you thought there was evidence on lost earning capacity, and that's what you argued to the trial court, and certainly you did put on a lot of evidence that this gentleman was impaired. So how can we be sure that the jury didn't put dollar damages on lost earning capacity?
I think we're sure, according to the reasoning of the first appeals, and we cannot absolutely be sure, is a short answer. We cannot be, but based upon the review of the facts in this case, I think that the evidence and the verdict coincide with one another to the extent that the verdict, even the jury, the award amount, still supports the issues that were left validly for the jury to consider.
How do we know what the jury plugged in between 90,000 and 67,000? It's spotting me that you've got medical damages up to $67,000. How do we know with any kind of reasonable probability what the jury considered in raising that to 90,000?
I think we make reasonable inferences from the evidence presented at the trial court, and I believe that it was reasonable for an individual such as Lynn Smith, who had been incapacitated for a period of time, and the record revealed his pain and that type of thing, that there was sufficient evidence in this particular case to support pain and mental anguish. The additional $27,000, I believe it was.
Did you ever put a dollar amount in your arguments to the jury on pain and suffering?
I am certain that I did.
Do you know what it was?
It was with 3.5 years history, I believe it was $100,000.
What figure would you think make the Court of Appeals uncomfortable in trying to decide whether it was harmful or not? $200,000, $300,000. Where do you think the Court of Appeals would begin to have trouble?
I think I'm not sure at what point they would. The argument in the case and the ultimate request from the jury was $380,000. And so they ended at $90,000. So in my mind, obviously, they were not in an area where they should have been. However, I think that that was basis on the record to even support the $200,000 if a jury had so found, based upon the testimony of Dr. Johnston, primarily in this case, and Mr. Smith himself.
But do you think there's a level where the trial, where the Court of Appeals would say, well, we just can't tell? We can't tell if they were awarding damages for this improper category.
I think that there probably is a level. Can I quantify what that level is for you? No. I think what has to take place is a case-by-case evaluation to determine whether or not those valid issues that remain support the award amount.
But how do you think the Court of Appeals is going to do that when there are non-economic damages? How are they going to know whether pain and suffering was worth 20-something thousand like the jury may have found, or 300,000 like you thought it was, or a different?
I think what has to be applied is somewhat of a reasonableness standard, and the reasonableness standard will allow the appellate court to review, and in those instances where the award amount far exceeds what issues remain. For example, if the only issue that remained was medical bills and a jury returned a verdict of $90,000, then it might, in that situation, be unreasonable. However, and surely if it returned $200,000 at that point in time, I think that the court could apply the reversible error rule analysis and determine that it probably was that the jury probably at that point in time, as opposed to possibly, made a decision based upon an invalid theory.
Mr. Coleman, but in fact, isn't that what the Court of Appeals did in this case? Didn't the Court of Appeals in this case, because in making their harm analysis, they recognized the problem, they went ahead and looked at the factual and evidentiary sufficiency of the other damages issues and determined whether there's evidence to support the finding as to those issues to before it could conclude that the including an improper, it wasn't improper, including in an instruction allowing jury to find damages when there was no evidence and therefore it should not have been, the jury had nothing to answer. Before they concluded that was harmless, they actually were forced to look at all the other elements for factual and legal sufficiency before they could reach that. So, in fact, in the harm analysis, they just didn't say, well, you know, it was harmless because there was other evidence. They actually had to do a full evidentiary review of every single damage element that was requested before they could conclude that submitting this one was harmless. So even though there's been a challenge because this was no evidence, they really had to do a complete review of all the evidence in the case. Isn't that what a court of appeals is supposed to do in the face of an evidentiary challenge to damages?
I agree that that's what they are supposed to do. I believe that that's what the first court did in this case, and I think that the decision that they reached was an appropriate decision.
Counsel, when the court working with the bar made a policy decision to head towards broad submission in the early 80s. Aren't the considerations on damages different than they are on liability? On liability, it kind of became a lawyer's game to try to work out conflicts in the answers or see if you could defeat somebody on one defensive issue out of six. And the pattern jury charge treats damages differently than it does liability. And aren't the considerations behind the broad form charge different?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, there's not as many games to be played with submitting six elements of damages separately, because the jury's going to have to add them up back there in the jury room anyway, as there are in granulating your charge on liability.
I think that there is a difference. However, I believe that broad form is appropriate in most instances. And in those instances when it's not appropriate, I think that we ought to intermediate or put blanks.
Well, why does it lead to a better brand of justice to have a broad form damage submission. What's the reason we'll say, okay, it's worth a little play in the joints, as we may have in this case, in order to promote this greater good?
I'm not sure of the rationale or the theory which supports that.
Do you think it would make a difference if the proponent of the issue did not argue to the trial judge that there was evidence to support one of the elements, and the trial judge gave it anyway?
I think...
Over objection.
Over objection. I do not think that there would have been a difference in the result in this case.
Even if the proponent of the issue admitted that there was no evidence, would that make a difference? Let's say, judge, look, it's in the pattern jury charge. Let's not take a chance. Let's just do it the way the book says. The judge says, well, fine. And the jury will sort all this out, and then stick it in there with the proponent conceding that there's no evidence.
If the proponent concedes that there is no evidence, I believe it inappropriate for the trial court at that point in time to submit such an issue to the jury.
But if he doesn't, then is it reversible without a showing of harm?
I believe that the reversible error analysis is still appropriate even in that situation. Let me just say that it appears that what is being suggested to this court is that we do away with, in part, broad form jury submission and, in part, the reversible error analysis. I believe that those are both valid propositions that should remain in the law. I think that to the extent that cases such as Iron Mountain and Walmart versus Redding have indicated a different result and an automatic reversal in those cases, I think that essentially what the effect of those cases would be is an eradication of 44.1 and to a certain degree of the broad form jury submission. I think we're headed back in that area where we've got jury charges, maybe not as Judge Taft suggests, of 40 or 50 in a particular submission, but I think we're certainly going to get back to an area of too many blanks, and I think that's an inappropriate road that this court should not proceed under.
One more question. Even if we found against you, if both parties agreed on a broad form submission, because I think the Chief is right, there are times when both sides have reasons for submitting just one blank. If they agreed, then there would be no error on appeal, right? I mean, any error that there was in submitting an element for which there's no evidence would be waived.
If the parties agree.
Right.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
I'm having a little bit of a trouble as you try to parse out the idea of charge error from sufficiency review. Since a challenge based on no evidence need not be made at the time the charge is submitted in order to preserve error, what is the effect then if you do have a submission like this and no challenge is made to the charge?
If no challenge is made to the charge, then what you're left with after the trial is over is just challenging the bottom line answer, because you've not complained to the court about one element of it.
Okay. Let me ask you another question. As earlier we talked about how you would do the harmful error analysis, walk me through the damages that the jury found for Erica Smith. We know that there was evidence of about, she got $3,100. And there was about $2,000 in medical expenses, which left a little bit less than $1,100. And the Court of Appeals decided it was not harmful error because that would have been an amount for pain and suffering.
Right.
Now, based on that kind of a record, how do you write
this is harmful error based on that kind of a record?
Because the jury was told they could consider medical, physical impairment, and they could also consider, I can't remember the other element, but I mean, they had other things that they consider, pain and suffering. Pain and suffering could have meant, you know, been the balance, as the appellate court found, but we don't know that. And then go back to Castile. And it
okay, but that again, that's error. Mm-hmm. How do you take that jury charge with those findings and tell me that that's harmful error?
It's harmful because we don't know if the jury was misled to think that they could award, say, $500 for physical impairment. We just don't know the
but
answer to that
question. If the jury
question.
Has been told to award damages, if any, based on the evidence that's presented, and Texas law says that jurors are to be presumed to have followed the instructions, then why wouldn't, as part of the analysis, the court do exactly what it did here and say that that went to pain and suffering?
Because we're speculating that the jury thought there's no evidence, even though they've been told that they can consider it.
But you have to show that it probably caused harm.
I think what I have to show is that I have to show that there was no evidence and that was error for the court to submit that. And then I have to show you, based on the analysis this court applied in Bonney and other cases, that could have misled the jury. And the jury wasn't told what they should do. What they should have done is not considered.
Then that's per se error, then. That's not harmful error.
Just as in Castile, where y'all did a kind of could have, should have analysis.
You're asking for a per se rule, then.
Yes.
Okay.
You know, in Castile, y'all stated a maxim. It is fundamental to our system of justice that parties have the right to be judged by a jury properly instructed in the law. That fundamental right comes under another maxim, equal justice under the law.
Well, but now, that language related to commingling liability theories, and it is the court's.
I'm sorry?
That language came from analyzing a commingling of liability theories, mm-hmm. and therefore the judge's decision on which law should apply. And there is law out there that says that is peculiarly up to a trial court to make that determination. Jurors cannot be expected to ferret through different legal theories on their own. However, there is a presumption that jurors will follow the evidence. And therefore, isn't it a big difference to try to extend Castile beyond commingling liability theories to commingling damage elements?
Damages elements are just as essential as a liability question, because that is the whole key of why they're even suing.
Well, now, let me again quote to you the Supreme Court case, that exact argument was made, the United States Supreme Court case, and the argument was made that elements of damages are, in effect, sort of legal theories that judges should work through. And the United States Supreme Court rejected that analysis and said, no, that really is sort of playing semantics, that elements that individual elements that are more factual in nature, the jury is perfectly capable, and we're going to presume that they can ferret through and not make findings on something there is no evidence of.
In Bonney, this court said that you couldn't assume that in a damage question where there is a no evidence element submitted.
Well, but now Bonney was reversed on a legal theory. Now,
if we had charge error in it as well,
there was charge error.
That was a cross point.
But it was going to be reversed. It was reversed.
But they had to decide whether a new trial would be granted on that basis because there was already an award for damages. They could have just rendered and given that amount. And also with respect to Griffin, the First Court of Appeals has not applied, First District, Federal Court has not applied that in the federal arena. And in fact, in its opinion, and this slide is 282 F3rd 44, they say it's not always easy to explain the discrepancy. The Supreme Court has not used the same presumption applied to Griffin in civil cases, and it gives some cited authority in that opinion. Also,
like Maryland versus Baldwin.
Correct. And it also cites there's also a law review article that is, I'm sorry, my time is up.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I'd like to hear what the law review article is.
Okay, it's a Boston Law Review article, and it's entitled Our State Constitution Matters, and it talks about how the federal analysis may be different based on your state constitution, and our state constitution matters. We have an open courts provision
okay.
that allows...
Okay, do you have the site for the law review article?
I'm sorry?
You said it's a Boston Law Review?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you,
Pardon?
Thank you. That concludes the argument in the first cause. We'll take a brief recess.
All right.